Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Tides of History early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts. Hi, everybody. From Wondery, welcome to another episode of Tides of History. I'm Patrick Wyman. Thanks for joining me. So one quick note here before we hop into today's episode. If you've enjoyed the chat that I had with Mike Duncan here on Tides back in April about the pandemic, I have started an email newsletter / blog with essays on current events and historical perspective. You can find it at patrickwyman.substack.com. If you like it, you can subscribe and get it sent straight to your inbox. And now back to our regularly scheduled programming. At long last, after 3 years, we have finally reached the end of our coverage of the later Middle Ages and the early modern period. As a way of wrapping this period up and getting at some of the big themes and questions, including some of the stuff I didn't really get to, I wanted to talk with one of my very favorite people, a regular guest here on Tides, Dr. Keith Plimers. He's an assistant professor of history at Illinois State University and a specialist in the early modern period, with a book coming out in May of 2021 with the University of Pennsylvania Press. He's also one of the smartest people I have ever known and a very dear friend. Keith, thank you so much for making time to chat with me.
Thanks so much for having me. I've got my special edition We Are All Peasants Tides of History shirt right now for being a return guest. So it's really great to be back.
Yeah, look, if we can't bribe you with t-shirts, are we going to be able to get you to come back on? Like, do we need to print up more merch? Like, do you want a mug? Do you want like a bumper sticker? What are we working with?
Oh, I definitely want all the merch. I was about to say no comment and not give away my real negotiating position, which is that I will absolutely come back on. But yeah, no, I definitely need to be bribed.
We'll get you a feckless shirt. I think we've got some of those. You and my children could all have feckless shirts. I'm a little nervous sending my son to school in that, because I'm like, what are they going to do? Do his teachers know like what this means? Like, what are the other parents going to make of this? I don't know. I should probably have some thoughts about that.
It'll depend how many of them spent a lot of time in Ireland, where that ends up being a substitute for a rather different term.
It does. That's also something that occurred to me. My Lord. Okay, so let's dive in here. I want to start with the end. I was initially intending to take my coverage of this period up through the Dutch Revolt, the emergence of joint stock corporations, the 30 Years' War, beginnings of the transatlantic slave trade, basically the middle of the 17th century. Instead, I stopped with the Siege of Malta and the Battle of Lepanto about 100 years earlier. So from your perspective as a specialist on this period, was that a justifiable choice or should I have powered through?
I think it's a totally justifiable choice, and in part this comes from a conversation that we started when I was teaching a class last semester on early modern Europe, and you were generous enough to come in and talk to my students, and the question I gave you, which is an impossible one to answer, is when should we start and when should we end the early modern period? And, you know, there's been a lot of writing on this, a lot of scholars have weighed in. But my own position tends to be that you can really break the early modern period up into a lot of smaller subchunks in a number of ways. And so I think ending where you ended in the Mediterranean, it makes a lot of sense for your approach to the period. I mean, I like it. As someone who works on Northern Europe, who works on England and Ireland almost exclusively, having the period and having Europe sort of recentered on Southern Europe and the Mediterranean in the way you did, I really love it as an approach. I think it goes back to one of the foundational approaches for thinking about this period, the great French historian Fernand Braudel's The Mediterranean. And I think in terms of the way you think about history, there's a lot that really jives with his approach to the period, thinking about big structures and then trying to put some smaller events on top. And so, you know, given the way you've approached this, given the way that you've really tried to draw firm connections between what some people might call the late medieval, but other people might call the early, early modern, depending on whether your job is as a medievalist or an early modernist, it makes a ton of sense to me.
Well, I'm very glad to hear that, because I've been a little nervous about it and I've been kind of second guessing it myself and trying to think about, like, is this purely for my own convenience or does the period that I've outlined here from like 1350 to 1570-ish, does it actually hang together in any meaningful way? It strikes me, as we're talking about the Mediterranean versus Northern Europe, that one of the big kind of shifts, not just in the actual history, but in the historiography, is that after about 1570, the focus really shifts to Northern Europe, that the Mediterranean, it doesn't become a backwater exactly, but the kind of the protagonists of the story, so to speak, are increasingly found in the north. That this is when we start to get the little divergence between the economies of Northern Europe and Southern Europe, that the economic center of gravity for so long in Europe was focused around the Mediterranean, around the great trading cities, Florence, Venice, Milan, Barcelona, all of these places were really the heart of the European economy. And after 1500, but even more so after 1570, 1580, 1600, that center shifts to Northern Europe, that it becomes first Antwerp, then Amsterdam, and eventually London as the hinges of not just the European, but the world economy. And so if we're looking to kind of break things off before that shift really, really starts, then even leaving aside the political events and the Ottoman Empire and the Habsburgs and all that good fun stuff that I ended with, there's an economic argument as well for it, a historical economic argument for it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, to some degree we can overdraw how much that shift occurs. There's a great historian of the Atlantic world, Allison Gaimes, whose book Web of Empire looks at the connections and the cosmopolitans, the sort of English merchants and others who are going to be really important for sort of building overseas trade in the 16th and 17th centuries. A lot of them are going to the Eastern Mediterranean and are involved in the Levant Company. I know other 17th century historians, my friend Jen Wells, who's writing a book on this, finds that Tunis is this critically important place for the English. Doesn't always work out the way they want it to, but there's an attempt at an English colony in Tunis of sorts that gets planted. And so it's not as though the Mediterranean just drops out of the story entirely, and indeed it becomes really important. One of the first things I ever wrote looked at the sack of the town of Baltimore in the west of Ireland in 1631 by corsairs from North Africa. So in some ways, you could draw connections into the 17th century that really line up with your last episode in particular, looking at a corsair in the Mediterranean.
Yeah, that actually makes a lot of sense. I mean, it's still profitable to trade in the Mediterranean in the late 16th and early 17th centuries, which we know that it is, because the actual volume of trade in the Mediterranean doesn't drop even as these alternative routes and other things are opening up. It's like the volume of the luxury trade after kind of an immediate disruption when the Portuguese first make the trip around the Cape of Good Hope, within a couple of decades, the overall volume of trade has actually increased even through the old routes, like through the Red Sea, through Egypt, through the Levant. The overall volume of luxury trade from the East has gone up. Like, they're mutually reinforcing processes, not exclusive ones.
Exactly. And I think, you know, this is always one of the tough things. Whenever you have to tell someone that you're going to explain the origins of the modern world or of modernity in some sense, there's so many different things that you can pick. I heard a historian friend the other day describe history as a tricky discipline because you have a whole ton of different strains going in, and then some event or process occurs, and then you have a whole ton of different strains going out, which will go in lots of different directions. And for a while, some might seem like they're going to be the dominant force that will govern the future, and then they turn out to have been a sort of historical blind alley, and then other ones that might not have seemed that important at the time wind up seeming much more important when you look a few years or perhaps centuries later on. And so I think, really, you've told a story that's coherent, and that's the toughest thing, particularly for the early modern period, because you could divide it up almost infinitely and tell a story about where something comes from.
That all makes a lot of sense. It's like, I'm really self-conscious about this because at the end of the day, like, I still remember graduate school and I still remember the seminars that we sat in together and just getting absolutely fried by professors and colleagues and like having to defend all of this stuff in extreme detail. And so that instinct is always going to be in the back of my head, even if I feel pretty good about the overall product that I've created as like a way of looking at this period, of understanding this period. I'm still like, how defensive should I be about this? Like, how many counterarguments do I need here?
Well, yeah, and the answer is infinite counterarguments, right? You know, you never get every, and even then, you're like, I finally have the one. It's going to crack the code. It's all solved. And finally, everyone will just know that I'm right. And then 5 minutes later, you think, oh, I forgot about that other thing. No.
Yeah, I heard that in Judith Bennett's voice. Like, I just heard something in her tone come across there, and I kind of got paralyzed with fear for a moment.
Fair enough. But I think one of the things that's really nice about the project as you laid it out, and particularly coming from my own perspective as a 17th century historian, is that you really are trying to locate some big shifts in the European economy in what I think we should reasonably call the history of capitalism and the development of institutions of both local, regional, and long distance, in some cases extremely long distance, markets, patterns of trade. You've located those in some real concrete shifts that happened between 1350 and the middle of the 16th century. And I think that's a really important story because it's very easy to tell a story about the emergence of modernity that is an 18th century story. It's really easy to tell a story there because you have things that feel even more recognizable in some ways, right? You have some political entities like, say, the United States, if we're going to go at the very tail end of it, that people can say, ah, well, you know, now that that's on the scene, it all starts to make sense. And locating those things in the 14th, 15th, and 16th centuries, maybe the very long 16th century, if you want to do that rotten thing that historians do sometimes, or the very long 15th century, however you want to phrase it.
See, that's something I want to talk to you about, because I've got a take, like a capital T take, that I want to bounce off you.
Yeah, go for it.
Yeah, so, like, I'm really confident that 1350 to 1500-ish really hangs together well as a period. Like, normally, that's something that normally gets called, like, the later Middle Ages. And I'm not sure that that's actually the Middle Ages. This is my capital T take. I think that the Black Death is such a stark break in a whole bunch of different ways, a whole bunch of ways, shapes, and forms. And the 15th century is in so many ways so unlike the 14th and the 13th, definitely the 12th, the 11th. I'm not sure what makes the 15th century, but even the second half of the 14th, I'm not sure what really makes that medieval. I think it hangs together just as well with the first half of the 16th century. I think it can stand on its own as kind of a little weird caesura in history, but I'm not sure it really goes with what came before.
Yeah, I really tend to like that. That makes a lot of sense to me. It's a period, and, you know, a book that both of us like, Bruce Campbell's Great Transition, I think tries to sketch that out as well and say, well, there's something about this period that needs to be hived off and set on its own. That does make a lot of sense to me. And one of the things I do like about that as a period is, again, I think some of those big structural shifts in the European economy, in the nature of governance that shows up, right? You're going to get state formation, as I know that you've talked about a bunch, but getting state formation there is going to be really important. And making that a period in and of itself, I think, really does, in a way that I like, is it allows you to create something that is identifying these things, showing up, and achieving a kind of coherent form prior to the 18th century. And you'll notice I'm sort of skipping the 17th century here, and that's deliberate because the 17th century is really tricky. There's been a ton of debates from historians for a long time about, well, what exactly is the 17th century doing? What is it contributing to the story? There's the idea that there's a 17th century crisis, which used to be really important in part because it was bound up in ideas about the emergence of capitalism or the emergence of particular types of states showing up. And that literature is still around. The historian Jeffrey Parker wrote a book, Global Crisis, trying to connect it to the Little Ice Age and to climate change. And so there's still something in that argument. But in a lot of other cases, the 17th century can be tricky to kind of fit in. You have all this big stuff that feels like it happens in the 18th century, and you have some of this stuff in the 16th century that's really important. What do you do with it? But I really like your period because it gives us a way to locate some really important processes and to put them into a world that for a lot of people does feel medieval in some sense. It doesn't have the sort of same modernness of parts of the 17th century, much of the 18th century, and there's a huge value in that because it destabilizes the idea of, well, what exactly is modern, and I think super useful and helpful ways.
Okay, well, so that's, now that we've got that out of the way, I think that's what I'm going to write my next book about. I just finished the draft of the first one, and now I think, okay, I'm going to write that book about the 15th century next. That's, okay, we're set. Project set in the schedule.
Good, I'll look forward to teaching it in a few years.
I want to come back to the 17th century. We've talked about this. You're a specialist on this period. We've talked about it in some depth before in one of our previous interviews. So you talked a little bit about global crisis, about the Little Ice Age. From your perspective, is there something that makes the 17th century hang together? Do we need to like break it up in the middle because of the 30 Years' War, the Peace of Westphalia, the English Civil War? I mean, not a small deal. Like, do we need to break it up in the middle, or do you think that there are some kind of unities that pull the whole century together?
So I think there are some unities that pull it together. I think you could make a totally coherent case for breaking it up around 1648, and indeed, when I was an undergrad in the European history course, that was sort of a Western Civ course, sort of not. The European history course I took, 1648 was the breaking point between 1 and 2. Sometimes now people split them up around 1600. Other times people will split at 1789. But 1648 and that Peace of Westphalia was critically important in the very first college history course I took as this dividing line between what was pre-modern and what was modern. So, and there's something to that. At the same time, coming from my own specialty looking in English history, I really think that there are broad continuities that link together the political conflicts, the projects, the attempts at building the state, figuring out how it should work, that draw together the very beginning of the 17th century to the very end of it. Right? I think when you see some of the conflicts that are going to shape 1688, that will be about things like political economy, that will be about the nature of trade. My own expertise looking at the earlier 17th century, I say, well, there's debates about political economy. There's efforts to reform bureaucracy and think about how the English state's bureaucracy should work. There are fights over the nature of taxation, about record keeping, about law, about sovereignty and authority that are all showing up and are going to be persistent issues that carry on to the end of the century in a lot of ways. So, you know, there are ways to chop it up, but at least my sense is that a lot of debates that are showing up at the beginning of the 17th century don't go away even after a number of pretty significant wars and attempts to solve these problems through legislative means, through violence, through a whole number of things.
I buy that completely. And also because the second half of the 17th century is the birth of what we call the fiscal military state, right? That you have these increasingly efficient fiscal mechanisms designed to drive war on increasing scales that carry through to the end of the 18th century when you get the age of mass mobilization. And then you kind of, maybe you hit something a little bit different with the French Revolution. But like the rise of the fiscal military state doesn't just start after 1648, because a whole bunch of people are like, oh, okay, now let's start building fiscal military states. All of that's rooted in the 30 Years' War. It's the same people who are leading armies in the second half of the 17th century who got their initial exposure to war, its structures, how to finance it, how to run it in, frankly, the crucible of the 30 Years' War. Like that, maybe the conflicts feel a little bit different, but there are really direct lines that you can draw from the first half to the second, even if you want to talk about something as limited as changes in political and fiscal structures and processes.
Exactly. And I think if you get outside of a sort of Anglo-centric story. If you look at, say, the Dutch Republic, the 17th century really, I think, starts to seem like a pretty coherent period. You see institutions that start in the beginning of the century and then that are going to just carry kind of straight on. If you think about even the political conflicts between England under Cromwell and the Dutch Republic in the 1650s, those are meaningful in huge ways, and they're both related to some of the stuff happening in the 30 Years' War, but also pretty distinctive from it in a number of ways. And so you see the sort of new order and the old blending together there, and I tend to really like looking for continuities over longer periods of time and for trying to see what holds things together. And I think when we get outside of, in particular, certain types of political narratives, there's a lot more continuities that show up. Even thinking about something like the concept of improvement, this crucial agricultural economic idea that shapes how English people understand landscapes, people they encounter, ideas about government and politics, how they approach math, really covers a ton of stuff. Improvement is this idea that's going to stretch from the middle of the 16th century into the 18th century. It's even going to show up in the 19th century in, again, altered form. But I just heard a colleague of mine, Emily Pauly, talk about 19th century improvement in antebellum New York. And so much of the rhetoric feels similar to what I see at the beginning of the 17th century.
That's one of the really fascinating things that I don't think we talk about quite enough, is that historians love change. Everybody loves change because change is fun. It's exciting, right? But like, continuity is every bit as important because things don't just stay in place on their own. Like, there's a certain force to inertia, but systems have to be maintained. They require input. They require investment. They don't just stick around. I think one of the reasons why systems eventually fall apart is because people forget that they require maintenance, that they continually require the investment, both kind of material, emotional, ideological, to keep them running, to keep them in place. And so when you have these really long-standing ideas of something like improvement, ideas about community, ideas about how you're supposed to behave in markets, like, those things aren't just maintained because they're fun or people like them or even just because they work. Like, there's a larger project at play there.
Exactly. And just because something sticks around, it doesn't mean it's great either. I mean, it's funny. You could sort of freight either continuity or change with a kind of moral character that is really risky to do, because, you know, you mentioned in earlier on when we were talking, well, you didn't cover all of the transatlantic slave trade. At the same time, by talking about someone like Columbus, by talking about the Genoese as a site of European slave trading in the Mediterranean, by talking about the Atlantic Islands, as I know you've mentioned to a degree, you're getting at places where ideas about agricultural labor, unfreedom, the relationship between Europe and Africa are being forged, and where ideas that are going to prove durable and pernicious all the way up to the present about difference and about hierarchy are being shaped. And again, I think that's one of the challenging things, is that some of those ideas being hashed out in your period, some of the relationships being hashed out, are going to stick around for a long time. And some of the more modern kind of expressions of those relationships are distinctive. I mean, there really are distinctive changes in the way that ideas about difference, hierarchy, the emergence of race as a category bound up with ideas of biology, for example, versus some of the medieval ideas about difference, which are sort of race-like, but don't have that kind of underpinning in senses of what bodies are and how they work and what traits are, how they get passed on, things like that. You know, those differences, those changes over time are really important. By the same token, you have already hit on stuff, on these things that are going to be essential foundational work for what's going to emerge in terms of some really brutal institutions that are going to, by the 17th century, shape huge parts of the planet's geography.
If you travel for work, you know to pack two suits, business and swim. You know, with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/youknowbusiness.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
I want to stop a minute and talk a little bit about institutions, because institutions have been a really big deal, especially in econ and political science, for about the last 30 years or so, as a subject of investigation, as an explanatory mechanism, as a whole bunch of different things. And over that time, the way that people think about institutions has changed. And it used to be that if an institution sticks around for a long time, it must be because it's efficient, because it provides value, because basically, if it's there, there's a good reason for it to be there. People don't think about institutions that way anymore. There are lots and lots of pernicious institutions that stick around for a long time because they benefit somebody. They benefit somebody with the power to maintain those institutions. Like slavery in the antebellum South is a great example of this. There's this huge debate between the new historians of capitalism and economic historians about slavery in the American South, about is it economically efficient? What is the reason for this? And like there's to some extent they're talking past each other. Because when economists talk about it not being efficient, that makes it more tragic that it's stuck around. It doesn't mean that it's not important or that it was like less efficient than using free labor. That makes the whole thing more tragic, is that these institutions existed for the betterment of a tiny slice of humanity, as opposed to because they were somehow good for the economy as a whole. So like you have these two groups of people who are kind of talking past each other when they talk about like, what is an institution for? In what ways is it quote unquote beneficial or efficient? It's a kind of a historiographic tragedy, just to get us totally off topic there. But like institutions don't just stick around because they're good. You can lay down roots that end up being really bad in a whole bunch of different ways as long as they benefit somebody. I'm sad that I didn't get to explore more about the transatlantic slave trade, but as you point out, like these things are being laid down here. Like that's why one of the reasons why Columbus matters and why I'm not especially sad to see statues of him get torn down is because his attitudes, the way that he thought about these things, the way in which he was representative of broader groups of people, those wound themselves in very early on. And that's what we can think of as a continuity.
Exactly. It's funny, you mentioned that historiographic debate. It's a new one and an old one. I remember when we were in grad school, I don't know if you ever got assigned this book, but I got assigned Time on the Cross. And I feel like almost anyone who has studied the history of slavery got this book, which is written by economic historians. And in their conception of what they were doing, in arguing for the productivity of enslaved laborers, they were trying to combat pernicious racist myths. But wow, that book was not received that way. And when you read it, it's jarring to read. I mean, it really is. It's a bizarre thing to look at. And you know, from our own perspective, coming as we are embedded in the moment we're in, you open it up and you think, whoa, what was going on? What were you guys thinking? And yet there's ways in which the debate we're having now, in which people are talking about efficiency and things like that, there's echoes of these big questions that stick around. Why does this thing go away? Is there some way that we can say like, well, it's not just morally repugnant, it's also economically bad in some way. And it's ways for people to try to hunt around to explain persistence and change. And I think one of the real challenges in trying to think about persistence and change is, well, if the things that change, if the things that go away are bad things disappearing, you can feel kind of good about change over time, right? You can embed it into some sort of progressive narrative about how history moves. On the other hand, if things that are bad sometimes stick around a long time, sometimes go away really quickly, and the logic to why they stick around or disappear can't be embedded into some sort of broader moral arc, well, you know, studying history becomes a lot less fun in some sense. I mean, more fun for historians who, you know, almost all of us are perverse individuals, at least in some way. But, you know, it doesn't have that same sort of nice moral to the story, right?
I'm glad that my 3.5-year-old son picked that up early when he said that daddy's job is writing sad stories about bad people. Like, he really figured that out early, just purely from observation and peppering me with questions about what exactly it was that I was doing as we were all stuck at home together under the stay-at-home order. Yeah, no, he really figured that out fast. So this is kind of a bass-ackwards way of getting around to some of the big things that I didn't get to. And of the stuff that I didn't cover, I think there are a lot of people who are disappointed I didn't cover the 30 Years' War. I understand that it's really important. There's a lot of stuff that happens. It's a pretty cataclysmic conflict in a lot of ways. By some measures, it kills a greater percentage of the population than World War I does, which is crazy. That's absolutely insane to think about it in those terms in the middle of the 17th century with 17th century technology and institutions and attitudes to be able to do something like that is a pretty stunning feat of savagery. I'm sad that I didn't get to cover that either. I'm sad that I didn't get to the joint stock corporations, the Dutch East India Corporation, kind of new attitudes about finance, capital, negotiability, credit. I'm sad I didn't get to that. But I think that of the processes that I didn't get to, in terms of the way in which it fundamentally reshapes the human geography and economy of the planet, the slave trade and the emergence of plantation economies in the Atlantic is the one that I'm saddest I didn't get to, because I think it's the most important over the long run.
Yeah, I would completely agree. I think that without understanding how European colonialism in the Americas and colonialism that will spread from the Americas and end up covering significant other portions of the globe, it's really difficult to figure out what exactly the world we're in now looks like. That is, it's such a huge change. Again, I think you pointed to key roots for things like where slavery as an institution comes from, the way in which there are Mediterranean slave trades that Europeans are participating in that are going to be key antecedents. But I do think there's something where a lot of this stuff either gets supercharged, where it takes on a new character, where it helps to create new and durable and pernicious ideas about difference that happens from just the massive scaling up that is the European colonial project in the Americas. Plus, you add so much more of the story when you just add in a huge amount of land. I mean, it really, there's no way to tell a global history without it, right? Even if you're thinking about something like, did you ever read the historian Kenneth Pomeranz's The Great Divergence?
Oh, yeah. I read that fairly recently, actually.
Yeah, and so, I mean, he makes an argument, and yeah, I think there's things that are good about it. I mean, maybe there's some points of critique for it. But one concept that he has that I think is just a really important one is the idea that the Americas become ghost acreage for Europe in a certain sense. Mm-hmm. And the notion, you know, again, people have quibbled with this concept in a number of ways, but the idea that now you just have lots of space taken through acts of violence and into which Europeans can engage in economic extraction, political experiments, things like that. It's really, really important. There's just no way to understand it if Europeans had failed to violently seize as much territory as they did in the Americas. Our story of world history would be just totally different.
Yeah, that's the biggest piece that I didn't get to, that I'm sad that I didn't, because I think it leaves that part of the story fundamentally untold. Where I kind of disagree with Pomerantz a little bit and the whole school of what you'd call like late divergers, people who think the Great Divergence starts late, really with the Industrial Revolution, is if you really think that the divergence happens around 1800, the metrics that Pomerant cites are not bad metrics at all. Like, I think he's pointing to real phenomena where basically Pomerant's argument is that up until about 1800, there's no real productivity difference between Western Europe, what's going to be the heart of the Industrial Revolution, and China. That by most measures, and other historians have included places like Bengal in this, at least up to the middle of the 18th century, that there's no productivity divergence, there's no wealth divergence up until this point. At least that's my understanding of the arguments. And if I'm wrong, by all means, somebody should correct me. I think where I disagree with them is that the roots were laid down earlier. Like, it's not like the Industrial Revolution just happens and it's this out of the blue event. It's a question of, do you think that what matters is the divergence itself or the roots of that? And if you want to focus on the divergence itself, on how this happens and when this happens, then by all means, the 1800 date's a good one. But if you're interested in much deeper roots of causality, then I think you got to go back a lot further. And that's why, I mean, just a shameless plug for my book. I think you got to go back to at least 1500 if you want to find that, like, which still doesn't put me among the earliest divergers.
No.
But I think you got to go back a little further than that. That's one of the reasons why I wanted to stop when I did, is because I'm like, okay, at least at this point, we're still talking about roots and not the actual thing itself, like the capital T thing of divergence.
Yeah, roots, but not shoots, perhaps, to go with a botanical metaphor, this is the thing I always like to do. It's funny. I mean, from my own perspective as a 17th century historian, that book for me is something that's really good to think with as well. And, maybe this is why I wound up doing more academic writing and you wound up being a famous and popular historian, is that to some degree, as I look back at roots, I just find myself sort of tangled up in a lot of ways. Mm. In that it's, you go back and you see something, you say, oh yeah, that seems plausible. And then you look at another thing and you think, well, maybe that's plausible too. And I think the real trick, and this is really the trick of doing history, which is what makes it great and what makes it terrible for, I guess, every student I've ever taught, maybe, at the same time, is the sense that you're finding these things and you're feeling like you're making a connection, and then someone else has a different set of evidence and they're saying, what? Hold on a second. You should check this other thing out, because that's pointing to, perhaps a different root system that we could look at. And for modernity, you're smart to stop where you did, because you stopped at a place where it's a coherent story. If you had kept going, I think you would have found mycelium connecting your roots to other root systems. You would have hit fungi connecting roots to roots and transferring nutrients. All these wonderful little metaphors we could draw from plants. All kinds of ways that things get tangled up. And so it makes total sense to stop where you did, but to also say, yeah, this is a related phenomenon.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. With your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. Kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love, because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Take off 15 discount not applicable to partner-operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/.
Once you get into the 17th century, I'm not sure this is as much an analytical point as it is an emotional one. It starts to feel overwhelming for me. Because of what you pointed to, because of the way those things get tangled up. And I wonder, too, it's like living in a new age of information. Like, obviously, information kind of explodes with the spread of the printing press in the 16th century. And that was pretty overwhelming to people, that suddenly there's all this new stuff out there that they have to think about and they have to take into account. And like the horizons of the world expand. The 17th century feels like a whole order of magnitude beyond that. To me, I don't know why that is. It's just kind of an emotional sense that I get, like that as soon as I've stepped into the 17th century, I'm like, oh my God, there's just too much. One of the fundamental tasks of doing history, of making any kind of argument, is that you've got to choose what goes in and what doesn't. You're making choices about the evidence that you choose to include and what you don't, what you think matters. It's an active process of crafting a thing. And the more evidence you have, the more choices you have to make, the more you have to decide what goes in and what doesn't. What am I going to talk about and what am I not going to talk about? Why am I going to give this particular thing emphasis over the other? And to me, once I get to the 17th century, I was trained as an early medievalist where there's like nothing. There's so little to work with. Those choices are in some ways easier, that it's more about the interpretation of the evidence that you have than what evidence you choose. As you get into the 17th, that's where it starts to feel overwhelming, is like, yeah, okay, there's just too much for me here. Like those choices, it becomes a whole decision matrix that you have to run through to try and decide why something's in or out.
And I think what that hits on is maybe one of the most fundamental points of division between what people who train in a very particular kind of way to be historians do and the mode of thinking that goes into that, and history as it's popularly understood. History, even as I talk to my students about it, so often they come with these amazing, huge questions, and I have to be the disappointing person who tells them there's no way that a single human being could answer that in a way that is professionally or academically satisfying. Mm-hmm. And it's because the way that we break up our chunks, the way that we break up our periods, the way that we do division, a lot of it is determined by what sticks around through processes of accident, through the inequalities and power structures in a particular moment that are causing some things to be really well recorded and causing other things to just dissipate or to have a few spare words from time to time. And the tough thing about doing history is if you do it incredibly well, you can never tell the complete story, right? Mm-hmm. You were always constrained by how many languages a single person can learn, how many archives a single person can visit, how much you can take these sets of materials that are going to go through these periods of ebb and flow and try to put them together into something approaching a coherent chunk. You can learn a ton of valuable stuff. I hope so, at least. Otherwise, what are we both doing here? At the same time, you know, there's always that distance from life as it happened, or from what it is to live through something, and from getting a sort of whole story that can be frustrating. It makes the puzzles interesting from a kind of intellectual perspective, but it can make history frustrating because it can tell us so much and so little at the exact same time.
That's why I love composite characters as a device, is because you're just addressing that straight on. And you can use them as a storytelling device and as a means of emotional connection, even if the evidence itself does not exactly tell you what you want to know. And you can just be upfront about the fact that, look, like, this is my attempt to try to get us closer to lived experience, even bearing in mind all the things that we can't know, that, like, I have the benefit in the field that I'm in of being able to use that, mess around with that in ways that hopefully can provide a simulacrum of experience, even if it's still totally inadequate to the task at hand, which is how I always feel when I finish every script.
Oh, absolutely. It's the great Irish playwright Brian Friel did a play called Making History, which I don't think was very popular, but that I always really loved. That's about the 17th century, and it's about the flight of the earls and the defeat of the O'Neill, who's going to end up fleeing. And you have the scribe sitting and writing things down and creating the character of the O'Neill. Meanwhile, the character who is the actual O'Neill in the play is sitting and saying, well, that's not the way it happened. This isn't quite true. And one of the things that Friel said in some of the production notes and pamphlets that went with this play was that there's a way in which fiction and a composite character is a form of fiction. You know, there's fiction that hews closer to, say, some sources or some source material, and then there's fiction that departs further from it. I would say it hews closer, but it's still an act of fiction. And one of his lines was always that fiction can tell us truths that history must leave obscure, that sort of needs to leave obscure, and in part because of the processes by which we create and the source materials that we have to work with. So I couldn't agree more.
One of the ways in which you can see that playing out is just to turn to some stuff that's happening right now. Like revolts, popular uprisings, protests, things like that. It's something you've worked on extensively. I mean, we can't exactly get ourselves inside the heads of people who were out there in that period doing that. It's something they did a lot of. People, late medieval and early modern people, did a lot of rioting and protesting. I've written about it. I podcasted about it. You've written about it. How did people in those periods express their displeasure? I mean, did they ever get anywhere with it? What do you think that says for us thinking about modern day protest, riots, public violence, things like that?
So I think one of the key things that I start with, and one of the things that I hope people will bear in mind, I just published a piece on a really weird incident in Ireland that took place in the 1640s that shows up only in some English accounts of what happens in this rebellion, usually called the 1641 Uprising or 1641 Revolt, depending on who's doing the talking, sometimes the 1641 Rebellion, in which a group of people took some cows that were specified as English breeds and put them on trial, found them guilty of unspecified offenses, and then executed them for those crimes. And the way it shows up in the English sources, and people should, I think, honestly hear some parallels with the way that acts of property destruction, looting, conflicts with authority show up today, was that this was a senseless act born out of hatred. And in the very small number of depositions in which this incident gets discussed, it is often described by the English observers who are talking about it as a sign of universal hatred and of a sort of irrational, uncontrollable animosity towards the English presence in Ireland. And what I tried to do was not just buy into what those sources necessarily said, and to instead ask, well, why would people put a cow on trial? Why would people put cows on trial? Is there anything else that we can see to it? And I dug into a bunch of archives looking at changes in animal husbandry and conflicts over animal husbandry that show up through the English colonial presence in Ireland, through what's called the plantations, in which a bunch of land is seized, given over to Protestants from England, and to a lesser degree, at least in some places, from Scotland. And there's quite a lot of friction around cows, around how animal husbandry is changing, around enclosing fields to have hay so you can have fat cows to sell on the market. And so I tried to trace out the way in which changes that come from the imposition and the rise of a commercial market in cows creates conditions of vulnerability that are going to get exacerbated by climatic shocks, by debt markets, and by economic crises, and that are going to make it really easy for people to associate their misery with an English breed of cow. And it took me 10,000 words to make this case for one act of symbolic violence that happened 400 years ago. And even then, I think my argument's good. I think it's pretty darn good. But I admit in the piece that it's quite possible this is overdetermined, that other participants might have actually just said, I hate English things and this cow is an English thing, so yeah, let's do something nasty to it. That others might have been concerned with particular injustices that they felt were meted out by English law, which is showing up in the region in some very specific ways just beforehand. So there's often a lot going on, and when we talk about protests in our current moment that involve acts of property destruction, of breaking physical objects, whether it's tearing down a statue or looting a grocery store, we don't know the motivations behind it. The records that we have, even in our kind of information-saturated present, are not necessarily likely to give us a full and clear sense about why something might be getting targeted. and that what appears completely irrational or motivated by sort of crude economic concerns or something like that to someone far distant from the scenario, that there can be something much richer going on the ground. And so I guess my keynote from what I've learned, at least studying this, is humility is a virtue when you're trying to figure these things out. In all seriousness, we have a ton of political commentators, journalists, all weighing in, and humility would be a huge virtue in terms of trying to assess people's motivations.
I completely agree with that, because a lot of it is, this comes through when you read accounts of things like the 1381 Peasants' Rebellion or Jack Cade's Rebellion in England in the Middle Ages, or the German Peasants' War in 1524, 1525. You get a lot of what you would call in present-day parlance telling on yourself when it comes to outside observers talking about protests, riots, acts of public violence. You get a lot of people who are watching it reading their own concerns, fears, anxieties about the way they behave, about their social order, onto the people who are engaging in this act of revolt or rebellion. The things that they're worried about, that they're concerned about, and I think I've written a little bit about this. I think I'm probably guilty of doing this too, that like we all read our own anxieties onto any sort of disorder. And people who are directly affected by it, who are directly observing it, are no different today, are in that sense no different than people in the distant past. That like we take the things that we're worried about and we're projecting to some real and meaningful extent onto the crowds we see.
Exactly. And I think this is a case where we've had literally decades of crowd studies at this point, and of historians seeking to analyze the motivations, logic, and character of mass protests, of acts of popular violence, and of revolt. And I think some of the key things that have shown up more recently and that are important for us to bear in mind, particularly in our present moment, is that popular violence and revolt can have a diverse ideological character. Mm-hmm. So I've really loved the work of a medieval historian who does early modern stuff. Whether she's a medievalist or early modernist, you'd have to ask her. Shannon McSheffrey, who's written on the evil May Day riots of 1517 in London. And she's made the point, in particular speaking to this long history that sort of sees popular revolt as at times having what we might call progressive ends or liberatory ends. In her case, it's an apprentice revolt that shows significant elements of xenophobia, of attacks on foreigners in London. And I think by the time we get to the 18th century, if you see something like the 18th century anti-Catholic Gordon riots in 1780, or later riots, church and king riots of the 1790s, popular violence can be both a challenge to political authority, but can also be framed as a way to attempt to support it. And actually, I think if we look over the past few months, even in the U.S., you have seen mass gatherings in which there is the either implicit or explicit threat of violence that are meant to support a particular type of political order and political authority. And you have seen mass gatherings and protests that sometimes involve physical confrontations with the forces of order of the state, and that are seeking a sort of liberation from the current order of things. And so I think that's another way in which thinking about and reading in the past can help us, because there's a sort of response, and it's born out of a particular, and I think a particularly blinkered view of modernity, that sees a gradual falling away of political violence. And in part, the only way that you can get this story of modernity in which things like popular revolts and uprisings disappear and violence becomes the sole tool of formalized states, except in a couple of odd circumstances, is by ignoring how much stuff is going on the ground, right? This story about a monopoly of violence going back to Max Weber. I mean, how on earth does that hold true in any honest accounting of U.S. history, mm-hmm. right? There's no way to understand U.S. history without seeing the ways in which popular violence and popular violence put to vicious racist ends in a number of cases. I mean, how else are you going to describe acts of lynching, things like that, except as acts of popular violence that are put to the use of preserving a particular type of social order?
Yeah, it requires you to think differently about the nature of that order and the role of basically privatized violence in sustaining it, right? Like, you have to expand outside of kind of the Weberian sociological definition of how a state functions and how it wields violence if you're going to make sense of those events.
I think that your Substack essay on thinking about the role of the police in social order in American society did a lot to capture that, because it gets at the ways in which violence is a structuring force of U.S. political order. And so there's this sort of weird locution in which things become violent.
Yeah.
It shows up all the time, right? All you have to do is turn on the local news or go through some national print publications, and that turn of phrase, turns violent, will show up. And I think if there is one thing that history can help us to think with, it is trying to understand where violence is present, the ways in which violence structures social order, the ways in which even things like formalized violence by designated state actors don't magically somehow cease to be violent just because of the identity of the person going out and committing the violence. There's ways in which we have to think about, in many cases, this sort of pervasive violence within social orders, and not the idea that all of a sudden something just turned violent.
Yeah, it treats violence as external to the system rather than an integral part of it, which is probably a more historically accurate and kind of analytically meaningful way of looking at it. On that note, Keith, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it. It is always a pleasure to chat with you. You always get me thinking about what we can and can't know in ways that just like get my mind racing for days, weeks, and months at a time.
It's absolutely a blast to talk to you. It's funny. We could stop recording now and then come back 5 minutes later and probably talk for another 2 hours. So
oh, yeah.
It's always a blast.
Yeah, we're going to keep doing this. You are our most frequent guest on Tides, and you will continue to be. Thank you so much, Keith. I appreciate it.
All right. See you later.
Thanks so much for joining me today. Be sure and drop me a line if you'd like to chat about the fall of the Roman Empire or the rise of the modern world. You can find me on Twitter at @Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at @PatrickWymanMMA. You can follow the show at Tides History. If you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe to Tides of History on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you're listening to this right now. If you've been enjoying the show, I'd really appreciate it if you left a 5-star rating and a review. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Morgan Jaffe. From Wondery, the executive producers are Leah Sutherland and Hernan Lopez. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
Yo, Trey.
Yeah, Kevin, what's up, man?
I was just thinking, what would have happened if Drew Brees didn't fail his physical with the Dolphins and ended up playing under Nick Saban in Miami?
There's a good shot the Finns establish a dynasty. Tom Brady and Bill Belichick probably don't become GOATs, and Tuscaloosa doesn't become the center of the college football universe.
That's a butterfly effect for real.
Hey, I'm Trey Wingo.
And I'm Kevin Frazier. We're teaming up on a new weekly sports podcast from Wondery, Alternate Routes.
As former SportsCenter anchors and current sports obsessives, we're consumed by all the what-if questions that make being a sports fan so excruciatingly fun.
If you're like us, then you also live and die on the fallout from every drop pass
or play call.
Intercepted at the goal line by Malcolm Butler.
Sorry, Marshawn, still too soon. Each week on Alternate Routes, we'll take a flashpoint in sports, break down what actually happened, then explore every alternate scenario and the ripple effects it would have caused.
Follow Alternate Routes on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.